Welcome to the Democratic Yorkshire podcast produced by The Hidden Power. It's a discussion hosted by me, Philip Tottenham, presenter of The Hidden Power podcast. And my guests today are Ed Straw, former chair of DEMOS, the Democracy Think Tank, and as fellow at the Open University with the Applied Systems Thinking and Practice Group, is all about systems of government.
Hello.
And today we also have a particular specialist in our topic of the day, regionalization, who in addition to his professorial CV is a veteran consultant to both public and private sectors, and that is Professor Malcolm Prowell.
Hello.
Hello. Well, you're both very welcome. And we are sitting here today because you both have concluded, along with many other people, that our current governance system is broken. And there is some convergence, I think, between you and others on how we might go about fixing it. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of all that, could you perhaps please spell out how you each got to where you are now? And in particular, what were the turning points where you experienced grounds for either pessimism or optimism with regards to governance systems in the UK? Maybe starting with you, Malcolm, would you like to kick off?
Yes, certainly, Ed. Well, I think I'd start by saying, well, I got to where I am now by accident rather than planned, but that's another story, I guess, really. But I suppose a number of things to say, really, is my career, much of it's been involved with the issue of public policy and the finance of public services, and that's meant that I've worked in many parts of the public sector, I mean, local government, health, education. Clearly, I'm in academic life now, where I'm an active teacher and researcher. But in the 80s, I joined the consulting firm Coopers & Lybrand, which is where Ed and I met many, many years ago. And that was around the period where consultants were starting to get involved with the public sector. And so I was, and Ed was as well, very much involved in a lot of the policy developments undertaken by the Thatcher government for many years. And clearly consultants have gone on to work for other governments as well. I've also had a sort of long-term interest and involvement in politics. I'm not an activist, but I'm very much an observer, though I have family members who are far more active in politics than I am. But I did gain certain insights. For example, I had a couple of long secondments to central government departments in Whitehall, so I was able to observe
to see the belly of the beast, as it were.
Yes, yes. I was able to observe, you know, how policy was developed and not developed. And that taught me quite a few lessons about the limitations of the government machinery. The other side of the coin is that I've also been an advisor to a House, two House of Commons select committees, actually, for a period of months. So I was able to observe the way select committees work. And I was also a advisor to a number of shadow ministers of health, again, back in the 80s and 90s period. So I was able to observe the government process as well. As far as my act's concerned, yes, you're absolutely right. I was born in Wales. I live in Wales. It's a giveaway straight away with my accent. But because when we talk about regional government, one thing to remember is that in 1999, under the Blair government, Wales and Scotland were granted their own, well, they're both now parliaments. So there's a Welsh Parliament and a Scottish Parliament. So we have been observing regional government, if I can call it that, for some 20 years.
Right.
In some ways, you might regard it as an experiment.
These are very important case studies, really, from a Yorkshire standpoint. Yes.
That's right. Now, I mean, we probably come off.
The population is comparable to Scotland, isn't it?
Well, it's comparable to Scotland. It's almost twice that, Yorkshire's almost twice that of Wales. And I'm sure we'll come on to this, but, you know, you'll find differing views about the success and otherwise of the Welsh government. But the house hasn't fallen in, let's put it that way. You know, the public services are up and running. Maybe things could be done better. It works to a certain degree, certainly.
Well, certainly that's a good place. Let's pause that for a second and hear a bit more from Ed. So, Ed, what's kind of made you think the way you think, and what are the main turning points in your experience today?
I gradually worked my way up, or indeed down, depending on your perspective, in government and politics. So, I mean, like Malcolm, the 80s and all of those reforms, and indeed the takeoff of management consulting in, well, all sorts of environments, but particularly in the public sector in the UK. And we really were focused on trying to improve things. Consulting then in those days is quite a different world. But then I got into a similar vein with the Labour government and their public sector reforms. But I had a parallel career because I was getting involved in what was called in the 80s the modernisation of the Labour Party, trying to take it away from its sort of 19th century roots and say, look, here is the modern world. Now, what can you do about the modern world? So with Blunkett and with Kinnock in the 80s, moving into the 90s, I advised John Smith on the organisation of the Labour Party and how to turn it into an effective election-winning machine. Then into government, had some success. I've mentioned the Relative Values, a report. When I was chair of Relate, I did a report for Demos, and that was about introducing more consistent relationship of parenting services. That got enacted in large part. Some of it still survives. But increasingly, the nearer and nearer I got to the centre, and indeed, I mean, at one time I was advising cabinet ministers, senior civil servants, lords, ladies, etc. The closer I got to the centre of power, the more I realised that actually there wasn't that much power there. This thing was so distant from the ground. And you might have the finest constructed policy in the world, but actually it wasn't reaching those people that it was intended to reach. And increasingly then seeing the obstacles in government and the way in which things were done were real turning points to me that said, yeah, we need a different system.
Yeah, I think that one thing you've mentioned before is this thing that we wait for a messiah to come and deliver us from whatever our policy malaises may be. But you've said before that it's not so much about the people as about the system in which they're operating.
I mean, we have this crazy, I'm sure Malcolm's experienced the same, this crazy obsession with leaders. Mm. You know, who is the leader? Who is this person, this great, wonderful? And I mean, great, wonderful leaders appear very, very occasionally. But by and large, it's down to, well, us, people listening, to get going in an effective system. And it's the system that matters, not the leader.
Well, indeed, I think that what you were saying, Malcolm, about the Welsh Assembly, that it's sort of muddled along. Like, it hasn't been perfect. But then, in a sense, that sounds to me as though it's a strength of the system that you've got this far.
Absolutely. But I think the big thing we have to touch on is the fact that, you know, Ed and I didn't really have any contact for about 35 years after I left Cuthbertson Lybrand, but we've been in contact the last couple of years. We've arrived at very similar conclusions by different paths. And we've touched on this fact about, you know, the problem with the current system is that government is trying to develop policy, whether it's health or education, for Bradford, for Birmingham, for Bristol, all out of offices in London. Okay, and that's very difficult to do. Now, at the very least, for all its limitations, the Welsh Government at least is that much closer to the electorate. It's far more aware of what the local needs are, and to a large extent is developing policies which are more suitable to the needs of the people of Wales than the support policies to get out of London.
And do you think that your sort of shared observation there reflects in any sense on your experience as consultants over that time?
Well, I think there are all sorts of factors at play, aren't very quickly. You know, you've got this tiny top. Mm. I mean, at times, you can you imagine that? I mean, it may actually come down to one person, but certainly not much more than half a dozen people. And they may have advisors and papers and all the rest of it, but at the end of the day, it's a handful of people, this tiny top, trying to take decisions which are going to benefit 70 million people.
I wonder where, for example, you saw this tiny top at its most insane, as it were, or its most delusional.
Wherever you want to look, the courts and the prison services, for example, were an area that I spent a lot of time on in the 2000s. Mm. and they'd all been turned into agencies so that, you know, you had the Her Majesty's Court Service ran all the courts. You had Her Majesty's Prison Service ran all the prisons. Now, a systems thinking concept that we've talked about before, which is Ashby's Law of Variety. If you're going to make decisions for and run successfully all of that vast hinterland, then you need to have as much information about what's going on in all of those as they do themselves in the prisons. Well, there's absolutely no chance that you can do that. It's about sound organisations do this, and there are some sound organisations in certain ways in the public, in the private sector. No one running a successful business would seek to do what British government seeks to do.
I'm going to read out a section of the Democratic Yorkshire Statement where they quote an all-party 2022 House of Lords Select Committee. And they say in this report, England is highly centralised, with far greater economic inequalities compared with other Western European countries. In the early 21st century, differences between the more prosperous parts of southern England and those of the north in terms of personal wealth, well-being, career opportunities, health and life expectancy have been allowed to become ever wider. So we've touched on this sort of dysfunction in Westminster. But Malcolm, maybe could you spell out how does this filter down from this sort of distant capital to the to a region like Yorkshire?
Well, I think there's a number of things there, Philip. And one is when you touch on the inequalities, which is something I always emphasize in my writings. I don't think people quite appreciate how big the inequalities between London, the South East on the one hand, and the rest of the country on the other hand are, how big they are. It's not just economic, it's health, it's any measure you want. And although there have been some attempts to narrow the gap is still huge. It's been huge under all parties. No party seems to want to take this on board. Our economy is massively unbalanced in two ways. One, it's imbalanced between regions of the country. You know, the wealth in produced in London, South East is much greater than the rest of the country, but it's also imbalanced in terms of sectors. There's such a concentration on financial services based in London to the exclusion of all other things. Looking at public policy broader, I think, as you know, I edited a book a couple of years ago now on regional government, and I had a number of experts to help me who looked at public policy in the field of education, health, all of these sorts of things. And by and large, they're all terrible. The state of public service in this country is absolutely terrible. Everything. If I had to pick the worst one, I would say it was housing. That seems to be the most unsubstantiated policy of all of them. And again, I don't think it's all to do with the current government. I think it goes back much, much further than that. And it's all to do with this developing policy in London with a failure, a failure to understand the needs of the people, but also, as Ed said, not the plain basic managerial approaches. You know, it's all rather amateurish, I think is the only way to describe it. In 1991, the then Conservative government introduced a health service reform, which was called the internal market. We don't need to worry about what it was. And it was applied universally across the United Kingdom. You know, the idea we had one group of people buying the health service, another one delivering them. Now, the point is that model would work fairly well in London, where you've got a lot of hospitals, you know, competing for patients. It doesn't work in Cumbria. It doesn't work in Gwynedd, you know, where there are huge rural areas and there's one hospital within 100 miles. Okay. And this blanket policy was just applied for the whole country without looking at the details of the regions themselves.
I mean, I know it's going to back a bit, but there's another turning point. It was the reform of the health services and the reform of the school services started in the mid-80s. People have added this up, but I think, you know, something like 30 rounds of reform since.
Yeah.
And they're still not reformed. Yeah. You know, and at some point you go, look, there's an organisational truism in this. that if you keep working harder and harder to try and make the existing model work, there's something wrong with the model. And there is something fundamentally wrong with this model of centralization. The other thing that, I mean, Malcolm has said this, it, you know, Whitehall and Westminster, and this is not just the politicians.
No, absolutely not.
The civil servants as well, this mindset of we know best, essentially. Mm. But, this whole thing, go to the Foreign Office now, walk around the corridors of the Foreign Office, and you will see this extraordinary colonial past. Mm. But of course, they stopped running an empire, but they continued this colonial mindset in relation to the country. So it's still as if they're running an empire, except the empire is just the UK. It's just extraordinary to see two things, actually. One is what they think they're doing and the way in which they try and convince themselves that actually this thing is working when palpably it's not. But the other is that sense that they can't envisage decentralization, devolution, and so on. One of the things, incidentally, that was to draw the distinction between regionalization and independence. Mm. And of course, people get terribly worked up about independence. They get less worked up about regionalization. Mm. But of course, they're all part of the same thing, which is about devolving power closer to the people that are affected and the people that can do something about it. I mean, one of the great mistakes of the EU referendum was it was a dualism. Mm. Either we leave or we remain.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, the reality of the whole thing was we're renegotiating our relationship with the EU. Ditto with what we're talking about here, how far you need to go before you get independence is a matter of fine definition. What we're talking about here is regionalisation.
In terms of Wales, Malcolm, where was the dividing line at the point of Welsh devolution?
I mean, at the time, there was not great fervour for independence in Wales. All creation of the Welsh government did was transfer to a local regional government local services. We're not taking over foreign affairs or defence or border control. The Welsh government is responsible for what are basically local services, you know, health, social care, education, housing, those sort of bread and butter services, if you like. That gives you the advantage of those services being delivered by people who are nearer to the action.
And that actually brings us on to, again, back to the Democratic Yorkshire Manifesto, where they say, we believe that only by a strong and effective system of regional government, as established in other more economically successful European countries, such as Switzerland with its cantons, Austria and Germany with their Länder, and increasingly France and its région, can we hope to build a stronger United Kingdom? So, I mean, we've already referenced Wales, but what is it about the cantons, Länder and the région that has proved so effective in improving the lives of their people? And I suppose this is where we get to the nitty-gritty of what regionalisation is and would be for Yorkshire and what might it entail.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right, first of all. You know, virtually all other developed countries have some form of regionalisation, which we don't have in the UK. There's a number of things to say, really, and I've touched on these already. It brings the decision-making closer to the communities and the people. So people in Welsh Government in Cardiff would have a better picture of what was happening in the health service in Wales and or the economy or all these sorts of things than people working in London. So I think it brought that to it. I think it's a bit of ownership, you know, for better or for worse. We don't think our politicians are the greatest things in sliced bread. But we have elected them. We have elected them, and we might vote them out next time. I think one of the drawbacks, I would say, and I think you've touched on this really, is that the Welsh government and the Scottish government have very limited economic powers. There are limitations to how they can affect the Welsh economy and the Scottish economy and improve on it. And I would argue that if you had a model of regionalisation in England, it should definitely have much stronger economic development powers.
And how does that compare, for example, with Switzerland or Germany or France?
Well, in general terms, those European regions, Germany, for example, has much stronger regional economic development powers than the UK.
Just to add to that, I mean, we're not just talking here in terms of local services and them being run much better. We're talking about the whole economy.
Yes.
And that if you have powers regionally in Yorkshire, for the sake of argument, proper powers to support all of the many and various ways in which new industries and indeed existing industries can be stimulated, you can see pockets of expertise and specialism and entrepreneurship, which you can support and you can bring together. And of course, if you have reasonable control of your finances as well, and every other regional setup around the world typically has some tax raising powers, doesn't all go up to Whitehall and then is dished out sort of aristocratic handout way. You've got those controls there and you can balance off investing in certain transport links. You can balance off, yes, in education. I mean, what happened in Ireland to set Ireland to being a Celtic tiger? They put a lot of money into the development of IT skills. Because they spotted that that would give us a competitive advantage worldwide. Yeah. So, you know, there are all those things. Yorkshire, in common with every other region, has great skills, knowledge, capacities, and all the rest of it.
But it's sense that there's a connection here between the flow of money, so the capital, like the tax-raising ability seems to really position York as a capital city that is raising tax, that then has a direct effect on the local economy. And likewise, as you say, with feedback, there seems to be a closeness to the general conversation, as it were, that would be more stimulating for the local environment.
Yeah, I think so. And if I go back to when I started in public services, I mean, the amount of money which local authorities raised locally by what was called the rates in those days was a much greater proportion than it is today. The bulk of money to local government comes from central government, and clearly he who pays the piper calls the tune. Hand in hand with that money from central government comes all sorts of controls and anything. I was just going to say one thing, Philip. When we were talking about bureaucracy, I was trying to turn something up, you see, which was written in the book I edited. My colleague did an analysis. He reported to David Blunkett, who's education secretary. He discovered that in 2001, schools were receiving 3,800 pages of guidance from the Department of Education on some of it, critical things as hairstyles of pupils and uniforms. Now, you know, do you really need guidance from Whitehall and those sorts of things? 3,800 pages per school.
And if I could just add to that a further point, that all costs money. Not only does it cost money, but it puts huge inertia into the system, into the decision-making, into the fleetness of foot, into the speed of response. Yeah. And people say, oh, regionalization, you know, that means more governments. Well, it sort of does and it sort of doesn't, because you're going to take a scythe to central government and all its endless directions, guidance, instructions, statutory orders, and you're going to take that waste and put that into the construction of regional government. And of course, those regional governments need to be properly constructed themselves so they don't become bureaucracies. And there's a point worth adding here, is there's always a danger, and I think this has happened in Scotland, that, you know, the Scottish press for devolution, all the rest of it, they get devolution. And then what happens? Well, actually, you then get centralization at Holyrood. You've got another bunch of centralizing people with high control needs who want to drag it all into the center. Well, the regionalization we're talking about is not about, okay, it all goes to Leeds or York, and then, you know, you get the masters, the Yorkshire burghers, as it were, running the whole show. No. It comes down to the appropriate level of government, and indeed it comes down to the communities and to civic society to make the contributions, which are huge contributions often, in terms of all that needs to be done and can be done and people want done.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I was just going to say there, I mean, some years ago I coined a phrase which I observed, which was that in every organization, everybody believes the tier below them is incompetent. So right. They all want power devolved to them. They don't want to devolve it down. So again, it's absolutely right. We devolve power from London to White, to Cardiff and Holyrood, and they just held on to that power. In fact, they probably took power away from local authorities. We had a classic one you probably read about in the media, the introduction of a 20-mile-per-hour speed limit in Wales. That was a diktat from Welsh Government to be applied. It's very controversial. There's been all sorts of problems with it. There was a simpler way, just empower local government to look at this area and find which roads needed 20 miles per hour.
You've answered a question there, because I've been sort of wondering, what is it about the centres that accretes power? Like, why does power accrete in London, or why does power accrete in Holyrood? And it sounds like one element of that is this need for control and this lack of faith in people below. But presumably there must be some sort of financial, or if it's just the sheer bureaucracy, that as people need more power, they need, you know, like your example of the schools, you know, so many hundreds of pages of guidance. To me, that is a picture of somebody sitting in an office trying to kill time.
You know, we've got the whole global monetary system sitting on top of all of this. Global monetary system wants to suck up everything it can find into the construction of companies to provide services. The more that you are controlling services from the centre, the more that you can dictate that they must be contractorised or privatised or whatever. The bigger slugs those services are, the more they can go into these organisations like Capita and G4S and so on, which have grown on the back. These companies didn't exist. They've grown on the back of privatisation and contractorisation in the UK. Their share prices is being run by the monitored by the global monetary system. The managers are getting rich on the whole thing. You know, money is not necessarily changing hands, but nevertheless, in terms of the ideology of turn it over to the market, all will be well, then you can certainly get that. And this is part of the reason, interestingly, why the regions were established so strongly in Germany was precisely to prevent the centralization of power, which allowed Hitler to get into office. Yeah. And it's sort of like, oh, that sounds like a good idea.
Well, that brings us very nicely on to our sort of next point of order, which is, given that we can see in relatively clear terms how the centralization of power is sort of dragging quality, as it were, from the regions, the question is, well, how would we go about implementing this? Obviously, in Germany, there was a world war and they lost and it was forced upon them. In Switzerland, they had, well, there was the era of revolutions and there was a lot of focus on constitutions, and that's what brought about the cantons. But I wonder, looking at Yorkshire today, or looking at, you know, other regions in the UK, what's stopping us from bringing some greater measure of regionalization to these regions?
Well, I think my problem with it, through observation, I've generally come to the conclusion that every opposition party enters government unprepared. They're so concerned with winning the election, they don't really think enough about what they're going to do. The shadow cabinet members are convinced that all they have to do is get power, and they'll pull the levers of power and things will happen. And history shows that doesn't work. You know, the levers, you pull them and nothing happens. And I think the problem is, until you get away, Ed touched on this earlier on, until you get away from this idea that you can pull levers or strings in London and things will happen in Bradford or Birmingham, where it happens to be, we're going to have a problem. I mean, we read between the lines, future Labour government could be more centralising than the current government. Mm. It's quite possible.
I think sometimes the politicians are sitting there and there's huge pressure on them to do something.
Yes.
And you've got newspapers beating them up like mad. You know, something should be done. This should happen. This should happen. Mm-hmm. And so they're sitting there. Okay, we better do something. What can we, I mean, if you think of the thick of it about spin doctors and all the rest of it, it's pretty much reality TV. Yeah. You know, Christ, you know, how about one of these? Back of a cab, this, that, and the other. It's not all like that, but an awful lot is. So there's huge pressure on do something. So they then come out with an initiative. You know, here is, I mean, what I saw the other day that there's some initiative that we're going to stop all smoking by 2020. I mean, nutty. But it sort of conveys the impression that actually, you know, we're in control, we're doing stuff, we're taking leadership.
Yeah, we're forward thinking.
Yeah, we're forward thinking, exactly. And you'll often find these muddled and actually hopeless, but apparently heroic acts come out to the fore more and more as governments struggle more and more actually to do anything. So you've got all of that going on. Plus, you know, the colonial heritage of the people in the civil service who just think, well, it's our job to run the country. We're running the country. You know, what have you got to say? Mm. But our need, I mean, the people listening, Democratic Yorkshire, our need is to change the conversation and get people thinking about, no, let's not have another reorganization of the health service because it'll just be as bad.
Yeah,
You're nodding along there, Malcolm.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been through so many reorganizations of the health service. It's I've lost count.
You know, shifting the deck chairs as the Titanic sinks, you know, all of that stuff, fiddling while Rome burns, blah, blah, blah.
Actually, just on that point, Ed, that's a good example of how your neoliberal framing has rather sucked a system dry, how the centralized outlook has led to complete bluntness at the regions with the health service, you know, in terms of these endless reforms. It's just this sort of, one is a beat of the head on the wall.
Yeah, I mean, the health service is classic because fundamentally, and indeed, I was just rereading your book, Malcolm, earlier on, and it was making the similar point that health and big business do not mix. And indeed, big business has got into the private healthcare market in London in a big way, and it's declined.
Yeah.
I'm terribly sorry, but you know, this is not an anti-market, an anti-capitalism, an anti-whatever it is. They do not mix. So, you know, stop messing around and work out, oh, by the way, they've got a good health service in Germany, in France, in Italy, in Denmark, in Sweden. Why don't we have a look over there and see how their national health services are constructed?
Is this about purpose? I mean, it sounds like their purpose, if their purpose is to make profits, then their purpose isn't to make people better. Is that kind of roughly what it comes down to?
I mean, you cannot reconcile, you know, if someone's gone into hospital and they need care and you don't know precisely what that care is, how long it's going to be needed, and they need compassion and they need companionship because all these things actually matter to someone's health. It's not just, you know, what screw are we putting into someone's shoulder here. Those are things that don't get taken into account when a company's share price, a company's profits, a company's management bonuses are being assessed.
Malcolm, I think you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, well, I just want to say something totally different on the bit, talking about regional government. Regional government, if it's set up, requires some protection from Whitehall. It's the only way you can describe it. Now, if we give, this is not a political point because it's factually correct. Undoubtedly the case, particularly under Boris Johnson, that there were attempts from Whitehall to undermine the Welsh government. And probably similar sorts of things have been done in Scotland. So, for example, European funds, which used to flow directly to the Welsh government, come through Whitehall, and Whitehall decides how to share it out. Okay, that's that sort of thing. Now, central government cannot resist tinkering. You know, they constantly tinker with local government. So I've no doubt, left to their own ends, they would tinker and interfere with the regional government. So I think it is essential that if regional government was set up, it needs some constitutional protection from central government. It would be essential to have a written constitution in the UK.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right, but would that also involve some sort of institutional balance or check? Or
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And what would that simply be in terms of the constitutional powers of the devolved government?
Yes, the countries, the constitution would set up the powers of regional government and the powers of central government.
Yeah.
Okay. There's
no problem with that. They can be both accountable to the king. It's not because some people say, what about the monarchy? It makes no difference. I mean, the constitution is the constitution.
Yeah.
Do we have some examples of that in other countries?
Well, Germany is the one we often talk about, I think.
Right.
And there's a great irony about Germany, particularly. We and the Americans designed that constitution.
Yep.
But, I mean, we, the Brits, had quite a big hand in that constitution. It was a really good constitution. I mean, the Germans had the advantage that all of their institutions were obliterated. And this institutional renewal is vital to the continuing health of any polity, of any democracy. And of course, our institutions just become more and more sclerotic. So the Germans had the great advantage. They've been bombed to smithereens. Secondly, quite a number of the people who were formerly in them were dead or had fled, not all of them. And yes, there was massive financial support after the war. But if you reflect, you know, who won the war? Well, actually, we did, didn't we? But actually, who were the two most successful countries post-war for 50, 60, 70 years? Was Germany and Japan. That's quite interesting. Both of whom we put in shit-hot constitutions to.
Absolutely.
With regionalization, control of central government, devolved powers, localism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, spread authorities and so on. There's a surprise.
Let's mention as well, we've talked a lot about Germany. You know, Germany's a big country, 80 million people. We have to remember Yorkshire's population, I think, is about 5.5 million. Now, that is bigger than quite a number of the states in the European Union. Okay, yeah. It's bigger than Denmark. So this idea that, Yorkshire's too small for regional government, Wales is too small, you know, said the countries in the European Union are smaller. And they seem to be working very well.
And on top of that, if you look at and you can argue about the way these things are done, but happiness indices and contentment indices, in general, it's the small countries that are much happier and more effective. And I mean, places like Denmark, as you say, and Finland, and indeed in a different way, Singapore. I mean, actually, small is really, really good when it comes to government.
So, well, that leaves us kind of with our individual listeners. And I do wonder, so we've teased out a lot of these very sort of interesting and inspiring points with regards to regionalization and perhaps less inspiring points with regards to the centralized system we have at the moment. But if we wanted to progress this project of regionalization, particularly, for example, with Yorkshire, where can individual listeners go? I mean, is there a mailing list they can sign up to? Are there events they can go to?
So there's Democratic Yorkshire, which we're doing this podcast for, and it will go onto its website. And currently, Democratic Yorkshire has a declaration. You know, step one is sign the declaration. Step two is that from time to time, they run events and people can get involved in those events. I should add, there are other things going on in terms of Yorkshire devolution that people can get involved in those as well. In many respects, I always think with these things, there isn't this sense in the UK, most of the UK, of just how important a constitution is and how important that is to people's lives, you know, daily lives. In France, I mean, actually, they're more interested in the theory than they are in the practice. But, you know, in France, they understand it. In the US, they understand it. In Switzerland, et cetera, et cetera. So in some senses, the most important thing is to put regionalisation and the constitution on the table in the pub, for example, or in your book club discussions, or when you're walking the dog. I mean, assuming this podcast works for people, then promulgating this pub podcast, but other things as well. And it's that process, I think, that will lead to people saying, look, you know, forget politics as we know it. Yeah, we've got an election coming up, but how much difference is that going to make?
Yeah, there's a little warning we have to say here, though not everybody remembers it. In 2004, the then Labour government had run a referendum in the northeast as to whether they should set up a regional assembly for the northeast of the country. Now, it wasn't a parliament, it was a regional assembly. Now, when people looked at this, they said to themselves, well, hang on, this regional assembly isn't going to be given very much power. And on the other hand, and Ed touched on this earlier, it will employ staff. So we'll have more staff in the northeast, and we still have the staff in London. So, for example, this regional assembly would be running education, so they'd employ staff there. But we'd still have the people in Whitehall doing the same thing. So people thought to themselves, and they were quite to do this, they said, well, hang on, this isn't worth it. We're going to pay extra money for more staff, and we've got very little power. They voted it down. I wouldn't blame them. I've done the same myself. So we've got to be careful that the regional government we have does have powers. And that Ed touched on this, we don't keep the same level of staffing in London. Those staffing numbers have to be transferred to the region itself. We don't want this duplication.
But it does sound like that's probably a couple of steps away, whereas I suppose what we're really focusing now is on, maybe also on conceptualizing how the future could look. But in particular, this business of you know, where does one give vent to one's desire for regionalisation? I think
what was your experience, Malcolm? How did Welsh devolution come about? What was the process? What was the talk?
I think it was, if you remember, there was an initial attempt at devolution in Wales in 1979 under Jim Callaghan, and that was soundly defeated at the time. So in 1999, when the Blair government came to power, they had a referendum on it. It was only just one, remember? It was a very, very tight thing. It wasn't a, you know, overwhelming majority. And I think it was in that intervening 20 years, the sort of national identity of Wales had grown a bit, enough to, you know, take it over the line, really. But as I say, it wasn't an overwhelming majority of people who wanted devolution.
But it was, I mean, my experience of Wales, because I live here now. I mean, as Malcolm says, the Welsh government, yeah, it's, you know, some pluses and minuses. You do feel its presence. Yeah. And you feel that actually I can reach out and with one or two steps I can touch it and I can access it. And I
right,
can have,
which contrasts sharply with our experience of Westminster, I mean, even in London.
It's not even worth spelling the word Westminster and Whitehall.
Yeah. I'll give you a concrete example here of a difference, right? In Wales, prescription charges for medications are free to everybody. Okay, now this drives English people mad sometimes because they think, how's the Welsh government manage to find all this money for pre-prescription charges? But anyway, that's the choice they make. They have their block grant from London, and the Welsh government decides how to use it. Now, the reality is, I think it's for given the demography of Wales and the economic situation in Wales, I honestly think it's the right policy. There are many, many people in Wales who just could not afford the level of prescription charges that might be paid in England. It's the right policy. It might be the right policy for the North
East. So in Yorkshire, they may have a different set of circumstances, but they would have the opportunity to adjust such a policy to suit
them. Want to put your money somewhere else, you want to do this, and actually, you know, this basket of measures and so on and so forth. The other thing I wanted to say in terms of the progress of devolution in Wales, I mean, you've got a similar identity, I think, in Yorkshire. There's quite a strong regional identity around Yorkshire and being Yorkshire and so on. But within Wales, there's quite a lot of intellectuals, academics, activists, politicians who were talking and debating this whole issue. And in Yorkshire, that's what's needed. And I think, or indeed anywhere else. And I think some of that is going on. But that needs to advance quite a lot.
I suppose for people to be able to see in clear terms that in politics, to speak is to act, you know, that it makes a difference to talk about it, and it makes a difference to keep these ideas alive. And it'll make a difference over time if coalitions of the willing are woken up and, you know, activated by engaging with these ideas.
I think there's one little thing I would add as well. We touched on this. We talked about the Whitehall machine, you know, and the way in which it operates. And the one thing I would want regional governments to avoid is copying the Whitehall model.
Right.
Okay. So you need to think how best they organize whatever it's going to be called, whether it's going to be called the civil service or what, I don't know.
And where would they look to for inspiration on that front?
Well, anywhere, really. I mean, just take a very small point, okay? How are decisions best made? And indeed, you can see this in some of the Amazon tenants as to how they work, which cascades throughout the organization. You may not like Amazon, quite understand that. And it is the most successful organization of the past 20 years. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
One of its tenets is essentially you take decisions best through multiple perspectives. Mm. It's obvious, isn't it? You know, rather than just say us three now deciding on the future health policy for 70 million people, shall we widen it? Mm. One of the great problems in Whitehall is and indeed Westminster, and indeed in the London press, and indeed the London think tanks, is the very narrow traditions of understanding, which typically... Some of my best friends are humanities graduates. Humanities are fantastic, but they're typically humanities graduates. And I include economics in that because that's the study of the human condition. So actually ensuring that you have all, you know, scientists and technologists and management and operational specialists and tree fellows and so on.
I think I can quote that Amazon leadership principle for you, actually, Ed. I seem to remember it's that leaders, they're leadership principles. And this particular one that you're talking about is that leaders are usually right. And the way that they're usually right is that they seek to disconfirm their opinions by eliciting a variety of perspectives or a diversity of perspectives.
Exactly.
Yeah, I can add to that, actually. You know, I think we all accept it's well known that, you know, better decisions take place when there is a diversity of people working on the problem. Diversity means lots of things, age, sex, all these sorts of things, right? If I quote you, when I looked this up, in permanent secretaries in Whitehall, 2/3 of them come from public schools in Oxbridge.
Yeah,
it's not very diverse, is it?
Yeah. High court
judges is worse.
I mean, and it's unbelievable. And this whole sort of culture that actually, you know, the way you take a decision is by arguing. Mm. You know, who's the best arguer? And where do you learn how to be the best arguer? You know, you go to Oxford University.
PPE in Oxford, yes.
you get the PPE, the politics, philosophy, economics degree, the Blaggers degree, as I call it, because it gives you a little bit of this. You've got very fast brain. Yeah. Then you join the Oxford Union Debating Society, where they really get very good, and you come out a brilliant arguer. Yeah. Is that the best way of taking a decision? Is it rubbish? Don't even go there.
I mean, it's funny. Since you've raised this in my consciousness, Ed, every time I hear the House of Commons in action, I find myself holding my head in my hands just at this sort of yah, 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 shout, shout, shout. And the idea that something important is decided in this way is just so absurd. Any final thoughts there, Malcolm, before we sign off?
No, I don't think so. I'm not by nature an optimistic person. And I see very little movement in this area at the moment. And as I say, you know, it looks like very likely Labour will win the next election next year. But, you know, it already seemed to be a day moving towards centralisation. already.
But there is, I mean, it may be a long tunnel, but there is light at the end by virtue of the fact that, you know, we can look around the world, we can, we're engaging in these subjects, and down the line, as we kind of nurture this sort of flame of regionalization, we do see the prospect of that coming down the tracks.
Well, I go back to say how, you know, the state of public service in this country, and I just ask myself, how bad has it got to get before we actually do something radical about it? I mean, it's...
Well, maybe that will be the trigger for the people of Yorkshire to bring this on to the next stage, because there is a way, but it involves regional government.
And it involves, I mean, my last thought is it involves giving up the heroin of politics, you know, this process that we're all drawn into of political parties vying, of the knockabout. And even today, we're now expected to have an opinion on everything. It's a drug. Mm. It's really bad for you. Get away from it. Engage people in, I mean, this may sound very pompous, but higher level thinking, if I might suggest, about the system of governing that is going to do most to improve the lives of people in Yorkshire.
Yeah. I don't think that's pompous at all. I think when you talk about higher level thinking, what you're really talking about is taking a step back, widening the lens, looking at this thing in the round and thinking, we could have a better system. All we have to do is look around the world, look at Germany, look at Switzerland, even at America, which has a high degree of regionalization, and see how it's all been working for them.
And remember, all of these things are human inventions. All of these bodies, you know, we take the House of Lords, you know, the House of Commons, and so that they're just human inventions.
And we can reinvent them.
We can de-invent them and reinvent them tomorrow.
That's great. Well, thank you, Professor Malcolm Prowell. Thank you, Ed Straw. Thank you also to Democratic Yorkshire for the opportunity to have this discussion. And in particular to listeners, thank you for engaging with this important and, I would say, promising series of ideas. I hope they serve to fuel your political engagement. So, goodbye from me, Philip Tottenham.
And bye from me, Ed Straw.
And bye from me, Malcolm Prowell.
Okay, goodbye.